Can you hear me now?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I couldn't get my headphones to work. Sorry.
That's okay.
I can't stand the bloke. He's a bloody idiot.
I swear I will knock his block off.
Oh, and John, if you're listening, you're a great bloke.
This is Aaron Lewis reporting for the Badcast on World Homeopathy Awareness Week, or what for short. World Homeopathy Awareness Week is, of course, an annual festival of idiocy in which snake oil salesmen across the world compete amongst themselves to make ever more outlandish claims about the effectiveness of their quack medicine products. It's also a joyous time for skeptics like me as, for a few precious days, we rational thinkers put aside our petty differences and band together to remind the public that homeopathy just doesn't work. How can I be sure that it doesn't work? Good question. Actually, there are three reasons why I think homeopathy is just another one of those fairy stories I've been telling you about. The first reason is that despite the two centuries of research, there's still not a jot of reliable evidence to suggest homeopathy actually works in humans. Not a scrap. Not even a homeopathic sausage. The second reason is that the scientists, real scientists I mean, not people with diplomas in fairy magic, they assure us that the whole idea is simply implausible. And I'm inclined to agree with them, because a homeopathic pill at a dilution of 30C contains on average only one molecule of the active ingredient per galaxy, or something like that. And in the absence of actual evidence, I just don't believe that water has a memory which magically knows which one of the countless trillions of molecules it's encountered is the one that homeopaths want it to remember. The third and final reason I can be sure that homeopathy doesn't work is simply this. When you tell a homeopath to put their money where their mouth is, when you say, bet them £5,000 that they can't successfully use their homeopathy on you, you'll be met with a wall of silence. Now, I know what you're thinking. Who would be rash enough to make such an offer? Well, me, actually. In February this year, I proposed just such a wager with one Louise McLean. Louise is a London-based homeopath, writer, and editor-in-chief of the Zeus Information Service. The website, by the way, is zeusinfoservice.com, and it's definitely worth a read. My favourite post is the grandly titled Homeopathy Facts List, 54 Facts About Homeopathy. Ignoring the fact that the list contains 55 numbered facts, homeopaths have never been any good with their numbers, have they? I'd like to spend a couple of moments debunking every single one of these facts in detail. Fact 1. Hippocrates, the father of medicine of ancient Greece, said there were two laws of healing, the law of opposites and the law of similars. Wrong. If Hippocrates ever said such a thing, no record of it survives. In fact, historians know very little about his life. Most of what we're told about him is contradictory and was written down decades or even centuries later. We don't even know enough about his birth to give him a decent quality horoscope. And finally, we come back to fact number 5, which reads, the homeopathic provings of medicine are a more scientific method of testing than the orthodox model. Now, proving is a corruption of the German word for test, and it's the method that Samuel Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy, used to dupe many of his contemporaries. In short, in a homeopathic proving, human lab rats are force-fed high doses of homeopathic pills over a long period, weeks or even months. Throughout this time, the guinea pigs write down every symptom they experience. Now, when I say high doses, I'm not talking about what you and I would consider a high dose. I'm actually talking about 30 or 40 or maybe even 100 molecules per galaxy. Still, Louise says this kind of test is a more scientific method than, well, the actual scientific method. For that reason, a homeopathic proving is the subject of my bet. Dismissing the 1023 protest earlier this year, Louise wrote, quote, If they had repeatedly taken a dose every hour for the rest of the day, the sceptics would most certainly have felt the effects, end quote. Now, I bet Louise £5,000 that if I swallowed homeopathic tablets of her choice, at a rate chosen by her, she couldn't make the expected symptoms appear in me. Her response? Well, I didn't actually get one. Apart from that is a couple of curt emails demanding I remove copyrighted photos from my website under threat of prosecution. Naturally, I was happy to comply, and I'd like to thank Michael Marshall and all his friends at the 1023 campaign for not suing me for using one of theirs instead. Oh, and while we're thanking people, I'd just like to add my gratitude for the American magician and educator James Randi, who supplied the single joke that appears in my bad cast contribution this week. Not to be disheartened by Louise's reticence, I decided to carry out a homeopathic proving all of my own. For the last 2 weeks, I've been swallowing homeopathic arnica tablets at the rate of 1 per hour, except while sleeping, obviously. I trained my budgie to drop tablets into my mouth at night, but it didn't work very well. I decided that if I could make the expected symptoms appear, I would pay to Louise McLean's favourite charity the promised £5,000. Now, it's important to note that Sam Hanneman expected his test subjects to moderate their usual behaviour during the test. He insisted, for example, that they refrain from coffee, tea, spices and wine. I have done so. He also demanded that his subjects not play chess, and I have not done so. Promise. Luckily, Sam did permit his subjects to drink beer and take moderate exercise, and I have done so. During the last 2 weeks, I have been to the pub 3 times, not been drunk once, and on each time I walked the 45 minutes home and didn't take a taxi. Every scientific experiment needs a control, of course, and for this totally bogus and non-scientific experiment, this afternoon I bought a pack of 8 fab ice lollies and ate them at a rate of 1 per 5 minutes. The 2 weeks are now up, and I can exclusively reveal the results of my experiment right here on the Badcast. One of the distressing conditions that high doses of homeopathic arnica are said to cause are, quote, troublesome, continued, and violent erections. Well, I am proud to announce that, over the last 2 weeks, I haven't suffered from abnormally frequent erections. Not even when I catch a glimpse of Louise's lovely photograph on my website. You'll all be delighted to know that I haven't noticed any symptoms at all. In fact, I've been ruggedly healthy for the whole 2 weeks. Louise, I'm sorry, but I did not feel the effects that you said I, quote, would most certainly have felt, end quote. The same cannot, alas, be said for my orgy of ice cream this morning. My stomach is churning. I feel bloated and nauseous and rather dizzy. I'm grateful to my local corner shop for their poor stock rotation policy, as a result of which it won't be possible for me to spend the next 2 weeks eating ice cream once an hour on the hour.
It's Fluffit here from the Bad Bulletin, bringing you an item written by my fellow bad psychic admin, Amaris, on the very current topic of freedom of speech. Here's what Amaris has to say, and some of the questions the subject raises for her and many others out there. I would just like to start by stating I do not have a great knowledge of the law and its many intricacies, so this piece is my thoughts and feelings on the definition of freedom of speech. The libel suit against Simon Singh has, I think, brought the issue of freedom of speech back into the public mind. I know my first thought was, why on earth wasn't this man allowed to use a word he felt, in his opinion, fitted the description of the subject in question? I mean, surely it's our right to speak out, isn't it? Well, let's first have a look at the rules governing our rights. In Article 10 of the Human Rights Act 1998, it does state that everyone has the right to freedom of expression. This right shall include freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by public authority and regardless of frontiers. But it also goes on to say that these freedoms do carry responsibilities, one of which is stated as being for the protection of the reputation of rights of others. So in the case in question, Mr. Singh's right to state his opinion became unlawful because it was claimed he was damaging the reputation of others. Then we have the defence of fair comment, which determines whether the words were used in a malicious way or were honestly held views, which was the verdict given at Mr. Singh's hearing on April the 1st. Confusing? I find it so. It seems to me our so-called freedom is really not freedom at all. I was living under the seemingly now false impression I could say what I think. If I wanted to stand in a public place and declare my mistrust of psychics, for example, I would be within my rights to do so, but now I'm not so sure. Another confusing issue for me is how certain religious fundamentalists are allowed to speak about the hate of another religion or peoples in public without it being seen as an incitement to religious hatred. In the Racial and Religious Hatred Act 2006, it states in Part 3A, entitled Hatred Against Persons on Religious Grounds, subtitled Acts Intended to Stir Up Religious Hatred, use of words or behaviour or display of written material. A person who uses threatening words or behaviour or displays any written material which is threatening is guilty of an offence if he intends thereby to stir up religious hatred. I'm sure the use of placards bearing words such as Europe is the cancer, Islam is the answer would be considered incitement, but apparently not, as those carrying them were not arrested. I guess it all hangs on the word intent in that sentence. How can you prove they had intent to stir up religious hatred and not just stating their honest opinion? On the other hand, last year a 15-year-old boy was arrested at a peaceful demonstration outside a Scientology church because his placard included the word cult. He was arrested under the Public Order Act, which prohibits signs that have representations or words which are threatening, abusive or insulting. Funnily enough, I find the first example to be representative of all of those, unlike the boy's placard, which in full stated, Scientology is not a religion, it is a dangerous cult. Where is the balance? Let me focus now on the fairly recent incident with Dutch MP Geert Wilders, who is the writer and director of a short film on Islam entitled Fitna. In this film, Mr. Wilders shows verses from the Quran, matched with visual images which gave, in my opinion, a very powerful argument. This is an example of some of the scenes shown. Muslim clerics calling for the murder of infidels, banners saying God bless Hitler, and there is a clip of a 3-year-old Muslim girl indoctrinated and brainwashed to describe Jews as apes and pigs. He shows a passage of the Quran, Surah 47 verse 4, which says, Therefore, when ye meet the unbelievers in fight, smite at their necks at length, when ye have thoroughly subdued them, bind and bond firmly on them. All of which and more I find offensive, but not because Mr. Wilders has put them into a film, but because they are a reality. Geert Wilders was taken to court for offending Muslims. The British government invited him to come to Britain and show his film to Parliament, but the decision was changed at the last minute and he wasn't allowed into the country. He later told Dutch television that the British government had sent him a letter saying it believed his statements about Muslims and their beliefs as expressed in his film Fitna and elsewhere would threaten community harmony and therefore public security in the United Kingdom. But it's okay to let fundamentalists preach against the very country they live in. Double standards again, it seems to me. I mean, I suppose hate speech has its uses. It at least shows us where possible enmity lay, and in balanced view, it also shows where discrimination is against the minority communities. Finally, I will mention the Irish Blasphemy Law, which came into being on January 1st this year. It is a law which, and I quote, forbids anyone from publishing or uttering matter that is grossly abusive or insulting in relation to matters held sacred by any religion, thereby intentionally causing outrage among a substantial number of adherents of that religion, with some defences permitted. But due to a high huge backlash of opinion, mainly from Atheist Ireland, the Irish government have now agreed that they will hold a referendum to remove the reference to blasphemy from the Irish constitution, enabling this law to be repealed. So a small victory toward the right of our freedom of speech, which should never really have been taken away in the first place. I will finish with a quote which has been credited to George Washington. If the freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent, we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. Be warned. Thanks to Amaris for this thought-provoking piece. This has been Fluff It for the Badcast.
Hello, welcome to the Badcast on Bad Psychics. I'm William Broom in Sydney. How are you going? Some of you may know me as Kensington on the BP Forum. People often ask why I don't like psychics or mediums. And I got thinking about that this week because a Channel 4 documentary in the UK, I did an interview with me about my experiences with psychics. And I think one of the main issues I've got, I have a few, but one of them is that it very much allows you to negate responsibility, to put responsibility on something or someone else and not take control of your lives. My view is the buck stops with you. In my life, the buck stops with me. I take responsibility. Yes, there are outside influences, of course there are. But at the end of the day, it's your life and you make decisions and you have a certain amount of free will. Now, what psychics will do is they'll often tell you what will happen in your future. Let's say that this will happen, you'll become a successful lawyer or you'll move to New Zealand or something. And it almost encourages you to sit back and do nothing. And I've got huge issues with that. Because by doing that, you lose that free will. You lose that decision making. And then on the other hand, how often do psychics influence you to make a decision? Will you perhaps try and move to New Zealand because a psychic tells you to? I have had issues with psychics. Sometimes they tell you very dangerous things. One psychic I saw, a very well-known psychic, told me not to take an HIV test because I don't have HIV and so there's no need. How dangerous is that? Fortunately, I thought better of that, and I'm very safe, by the way. I've been tested and all that. But I think somebody perhaps more naive or more vulnerable or more gullible even might have done nothing and endangered not only their own lives, but somebody else's. Another psychic I saw told me not to go into a career that I wanted to go into. I have an interest in politics. She said, never go into politics. You'll be hurt. You'll be wounded. Maybe I will be. But while I believed in psychics, I actually held back from anything political. I didn't get involved. And it's only since I've become more skeptical and more questioning of psychics and mediums, I thought, well, let me make my own mistakes. You know, I don't want to sound awful or anything, but if you have a child, yes, you can tell a child not to touch a hot oven. That's great, and they shouldn't. But perhaps the most effective way is if voluntarily they do touch that oven, because they won't forget. At least allow me to make my own mistakes. And how on earth can somebody who doesn't even know me tell me what to do in my future? Tell me what's going to happen? I think the strangest thing I was told was I was going to move to New Zealand and become New Zealand's greatest and best known public relations guru, the Max Clifford of New Zealand, and I think I actually believed it. So it almost means I don't have to do any work, I just sit back and let fate and future happen. And that's the issue I've got. You don't take control of your lives. A lot of believers tell me, well, psychics don't tell you really what's going to happen, they don't tell you what to do, they just give you possible pathways. I've seen about 12, 13, 14, 15 psychics over several years on the phone lines, in person, etc. And they have told me what to do. So it's a myth when people tell you they give you options. They don't. They actually tell you often what's going to happen. I know somebody who was told that his sister was evil. He no longer speaks to his sister. He believes the word of somebody he's never met before, who doesn't even know him, compared to his own intuition, compared to what he thinks and what he believes. To me, that is worrying. And what we've all got to do is, yes, if you want to spend your money on a psychic, see a psychic. No problem. Do that. But at least know what you're getting yourself into. And remember, the buck stops with you. You have to take responsibility for your own lives. Now, a lot of people say, well, some people go to psychics because it's a form of counselling. Well, perhaps it is to many. But most psychics, unless they happen to also be counsellors, most psychics don't have counselling training. You know, a lot of psychics will make judgments. They will make decisions about your life. A lot of counsellors won't. They'll let you speak. Maybe they'll offer you options or whatever. But they're really a listener. A psychic's not. They give you advice. They can have a great influence over people's lives. And what we've got to do is we've got to wrestle back control of our lives. The buck certainly stops with us. And only us, only we can decide our own futures and what's going to happen. Not some stranger you've ever met. I understand that people have different reasons for going to psychics. Many go because they've experienced some sort of trauma. Maybe somebody's died. They want to speak to them at the other end. And maybe somebody wants to know about their love life or employment. Others, like myself, went because we were curious, we were nosy, we wanted to know our future. And another reason people go, and this is another reason I went, was to focus attention and be the focus of that attention. Somebody's talking about you and your future's being given to you on a plate. But what I've got to say is, fair enough, if you happen to believe in psychics and mediums, that's your right to. But read up a bit more about it. Ask yourself why you're going to see them and what you hope to get out of it. And if they tell you something, ask yourself why they told you that. And how are you going to deal with that? Are you going to take their word? Or are you actually going to go along with what you wanted to do in the first place and take control over your future, take control over your life? You are your own boss. Believe in yourself first. Believe in what you're capable of and do it. Because believe me, you will achieve. But take control of your life. And as I've said many times before, the buck stops with you. Good luck.
It's very good to speak to you. Most people out there know you under your blogging pseudonym of Jack of Kent. You've covered extensively the Simon Singh case. Could you bring us up to speed on where that is now, or where it isn't, in fact?
Well, the case has effectively finished. The BCA have filed a notice of discontinuance. That means the case comes to an end on the libel point. There's still possibly an outstanding dispute between Simon Singh and the BCA about legal costs.
Okay.
And the extent to which the BCA have to pay all his legal costs. But subject to that, the case has come to an end. And I think that was fairly inevitable since the Court of Appeal judgment, which came out on the 1st of April. And it's quite amusing that the case effectively finished on April Fool's Day when it began on Chiropractic Awareness Week. Since the 1st of April, Simon has comfortably been in the driving seat. First time in the whole case, which lasted almost precisely 2 years, he has had any advantage, because until then, because of the nature of English libel law and because of their success in getting a astonishingly illiberal High Court judgment, the BCA have been in the driving seat, notwithstanding that on the underlying issue of whether there was any evidence for these treatments for children, they didn't have a jot.
That's incredible. I mean, Simon took a huge personal risk in standing this case, really, didn't he?
I think he has been nothing less than heroic. It could have been incredibly easy for him at a number of stages just to have given in. Mm-hmm. He could have just made an apology at the beginning. He could have made an apology after the High Court ruling. And nobody would have thought anything worse of him. He tried once, twice, three times to get permission to appeal. Nobody would have thought any badly of him if he'd just given in. But he didn't. And reason-wise, I think there was a certain amount that he wanted to defend his own words.
Sure.
But there was also a wider constituency. He became very quickly aware that science writers, especially, and other writers and publishers, were feeling libel chill. Yep. Because it was so easy to bring a libel case which could put terrifying costs risks on the writer or publisher, and this was notwithstanding the underlying issues. And he thought something needed to be done for that, and this was an opportunity for him to do so.
I mean, there's plenty of people out there who would be looking at this case and say it's all very well for journalists and science writers and so forth, but it doesn't affect the vast majority of the public, but it does affect people, doesn't it? It affects everybody.
Yes. It's not just the selfish interests of particular journalists, which is the issue here. If that was the case, then I, for one, wouldn't be terribly interested. It's about contributions to public debates about, say, public health, public safety, the conduct of international corporations, the conduct of those who have legal power or economic power over us. Those contributions are simply not being made. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's because they're not being published, sometimes it's because they've been removed, sometimes it's because they're spiked by editors, sometimes it's actually self-censorship. But there are things which are just not being published because of not just the English libel law itself, but the actual litigation process and the costs, risks which are involved. As Simon says, it's not so much that writers and publishers are gagged, it's that members of the public are being blindfolded.
So it's very much a case of this battle's won, but the war, as it were, is still ongoing and tackling the wider issues of libel reform.
Definitely. There's been a dent put into English libel law by the Court of Appeal decision. Now, in my opinion, it is the law of the land that statements about evidence, when it matters whether certain generalisations are sound or not, will have the protection of fair comment. And what that means is, as long as those comments are made in good faith and there's no malice, there should be a defence of the writer. That is progress. And it isn't a sorry.
No, sorry, I shouldn't be interrupting. But yeah. But what could people do? I mean, what could people do to get involved or to add their support to this process of reforming the libel laws?
There's one immediate thing, and then there's an ongoing thing. The immediate thing is to get onto the Libel Reform website, mm-hmm. which is www.libelreform.org, and sign up onto the petition, because the numbers matter. There's now 50,000. It keeps it as a live issue.
Yeah.
But more importantly is to keep an ongoing informed interest in libel reform. Or because Simon's case has gone away, it doesn't mean that the problem has gone away. The three main political parties have, to varying degrees, committed themselves to some form of libel reform in the new parliament. The Ministry of Justice seems to be interested. Mm-hmm. We've just got to carry on following this issue and making sure it doesn't fall away. Because unless we do keep pushing for libel reform, it will be a fail. There's lots of vested interests at stake here. We are not going to succeed because we are the good guys, so to speak. No. It is because we actually prevail. And that will not happen unless we keep actively interested in pushing for libel reform.
Fantastic. One of the ways that you and many others have been spreading the word of libel reform and highlighting the injustices of the situation is through your blog. And there's lots of blogs out there. And you've recently been shortlisted for the Orwell Prize for your blog, which is wonderful news. What role do you see blogs as playing? Because I mean, I for one have a long list of blogs that I will probably consult before I even pick up a newspaper or head to any of the standard journalist websites. Where do you see as blogs fitting into the dissemination of information, the spread of knowledge?
I actually don't see blogs as a sort of new form of journalism. Some people do. I don't. I see it as a supplement to journalism. I see blogging more of a development of active citizenship than a reaction to journalism. It means that anybody who, on a voluntary basis and on an occasional basis, there's no compulsion, who wants to sort of try and contribute to a debate or an issue, and contribute either because they have a new insight or they have new information or they can offer some sort of analysis, they can do so. and they can take part in that debate. Yes, a lot of blogging is because journalism is perceived as being deficient. But it isn't a reaction to journalism directly. It is something which you're doing when you're blogging. You're doing something which journalists actually can't often do. You can link to various sites which are provided by various media outlets. You can't really expect a reporter to do that. Hard-working journalists have to churn out copy within a 24-hour cycle. They haven't got the luxury to be able to do a considered blog post once every 2 weeks. So it isn't a threat to journalism. It isn't an attempt to discredit journalism. It's actually a development of citizenship. And that's why I do it, and that's why I think other blogs which seem to make some sort of impact do it as well. It's because there's a voice to be heard within the debate, and this is a way of doing it.
There's so many good sceptical and scientific blogs out there, and websites and podcasts now, of which this John's podcast, The Badcast, is one of them. I've spoken to lots of people out in the field, and when I've mentioned that I'm going to be speaking to you, or that you were coming up to Birmingham Sceptics in the Pub to talk, they've all said that you've given them advice, or you've helped them out, and you've done various things. Without naming any names or anything like this, what kind of actions have you seen with, say, psychics who found themselves at the wrong end of a website? what kind of behaviour do you come across?
Well, first thing, I will name one name, and I will pay a great tribute to John Donne. He is an indefatigable web presence, and I admire greatly what he has set out to achieve with his bad psychics. And one of my blogs is called Bad Law, and that in a way is a sort of attempt to pay homage to people like John and Ben Goldacre and Phil Plate, who have done the bad ... movement elsewhere. As regards helping in particular cases, well, sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. It's not really for me to say anything about that sort of thing. But there is a more general issue that those who can instruct lawyers do seem to think that threatening to sue websites is a sort of easy option, a quick win. And often it can be. And that's because of the relative weakness bloggers have as publishers. But a blogger's position is not hopeless. There is something you can do in certain circumstances. It isn't the fact that somebody more powerful than you can just remove what you want to say in a debate just because they want to. And so, yes, I think it's great to be able to help out when you can, but there's a bigger problem here, which is way for powerful and the vested interests and those who don't want to be criticised seem to think that they can just try and remove websites, blog posts, just because they can afford to employ a libel lawyer.
It was great. I mean, it's great talking to you now, but it was wonderful seeing you at the Birmingham Sceptics in the Pub, which is your home territory. What was it like doing a gig back in your home ground?
Well, it was great to be invited. It was incredibly flattering to be invited to Birmingham Sceptics in the Pub. And Birmingham itself has got a fantastic reputation for free thought and sceptical inquiry. It was the home of the Lunar Society, of course, which similarly met every month, like Sceptics in the Pub, and discussed issues which interested them, like Sceptics in the Pub. Unfortunately, they got called Lunatics, which I hope isn't a name which carries over to Sceptics in the Pub. It was just wonderful. But Sceptics in the Pub as a phenomenon is a great thing. There is obviously Birmingham, but almost every major town or city now has Sceptics in the Pub in the UK and in Canada and America and Australia and New Zealand, and also in continental Europe, I understand. So it's a great forum for people to come together and promote the values of critical thought and evidence-based inquiry.
Whilst in the presence of quantities of alcohol, which can often be a bonus to discussion and the flow of thought.
Well, possibly, but a surprising number of sceptics don't even drink.
I know, I notice it.
It's because it's an informal setting. People can feel as if they can relax and participate in a way which they wouldn't do in a seminar room, even if it was exactly the same talk given by exactly the same person.
Absolutely. I mean, where else can you go? And you can see, you know, we've got Professor David Cahoon coming up, and where else would you be able to go to a pub and listen to a pharmacological professor and a great blogger and personality such as himself give the kinds of talks that he does. It's really good.
Oh, David Cahoon is a phenomenon, and anybody listening to this should get themselves to his session. He's a no less than a fellow of the Royal Society, incredibly eminent and distinguished professor in his own right, who blogs like a teenager and is absolutely sharp with exposing bullshit.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's great that people like David Cahoon gives up his time to come up from London to go to Skeptics in the Pub. It's great that somebody in Birmingham gives up their time to come and listen to him. And it's even better that afterwards there'll be blogging, there'll be internet-type discussions about what's going on. It isn't just what takes place in the pub. Sure. It's the ability to take these issues forward and discuss them more widely.
Absolutely. And in respect of giving up time, David, thank you so much for giving up your time to talk to me now, because I know you're incredibly busy. You've been very, very generous. And thank you on behalf of Birmingham Skeptics in the Pub, myself, and the Badcast.
Birmingham Skeptics in the Pub is every second Wednesday of the month at the Victoria on John Bright Street, right behind the Alexandra Theatre. Join us for fantastic speakers and good sceptical company. Coming up, we've got Dr. David Gregory, science correspondent for the BBC, the irrepressible Professor David Cahoon, the renowned Professor Chris French, and the excellent Andy Lewis, inventor of the quackometer. You've seen them on the telly, read their blogs and tweets, now come and meet them in the flesh. To find full details and how to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, simply Google Birmingham Skeptics and Pub. Remember, it's the second Wednesday at the Victoria. All talks are free.
Hello, I'm David Kempf. I've just finished my new book, Dark Fiction, and would like to tell you about it. An aspiring young writer attending a prestigious university is thrilled when the school's most famous professor, a best-selling author, decides to be his mentor. Although ecstatic to find that some dreams really do come true, the young writer is horrified to learn that so do some nightmares. When his mentor's dark secret is revealed, he realizes there are things worse than even those conjured up by a horror writer's imagination. I promise you that this book is very likely to be different from anything else you've ever read. It is a cautionary tale to aspiring writers everywhere. Never sell your soul to write a bestseller. You can buy the book on Amazon.com and read a review at www.mastersofhorror.co.uk.
You have been listening to The Badcast. Check out the website at www.badcast.co.uk.